Okay, so now we're recording. So I'm Nicole Porter, and this is a segment of the Faces of Poverty podcast with the Leadership Fellows of the Center for American Progress. We're going to focus this segment on the concept of justice reinvestment. The goal of justice reinvestment is to redirect some portion of the billions American now spends on prisons to rebuild human resources and physical infrastructure, schools, healthcare facilities, parks, and public spaces in neighborhoods devastated by high levels of incarceration. To talk about justice reinvestment, we've invited one of the principals behind the concept, Eric Cadora, director of the Justice Mapping Center and a professor at the School of Criminal Justice at Rutgers University. Thanks for joining us today, Eric.
Thanks, Nicole.
So, Eric, can you provide an overview of justice reinvestment and why this concept is so critical? I mean, one of the issues we've been focused on quite extensively in recent years is the high rate of incarceration in the United States. In fact, we know that the U.S. has 5% of the world's general population and 25% of the world's prison population. So why justice reinvestment?
Right. Well, fine question. And even in the question is an interesting question, which is, you know, which justice reinvestment? Because one of the original ideas behind reinvestment was that we were really mired in a, at the time that we sort of first launched the idea back in early 2000s, 2002, 2003, is that we were mired in a kind of get tough or being soft polemic that was kind of freezing up the discussion on crime and public safety in the U.S. And one of the things we wanted to do in thinking about reinvestment and unlocking that conversation to address this highly disproportionate use of prison resources was to change the language and try to reframe the concepts behind that conversation in a way that allowed people, we think, and I think it's proven true over the last decade, that allows people to, in fact, discuss possible more pragmatic and productive ways to address public safety than the kind of one line, lock them up, concrete walls, iron bars kind of approach. Justice reinvestment was first and foremost an attempt to reframe that question around the places where the impact of incarceration was really showing, hitting the road, you know, kind of where the rubber hits the road. And that was at local communities, because what our research showed by doing sort of mapping the question, mapping where people reside in concentration, who go in and out of prison, was that it's highly, the phenomenon of incarceration is highly focused in very particular small areas within every city in the country. So that a huge proportion of people going to prison from any particular city, let's say, came from a few, primarily from a few neighborhoods in those cities. And the question was, what's going on there? What if we start the conversation by looking at that, the very basic demographics of incarceration? And once we did that, I think it enabled, first and foremost, the Justice Reinvestment Initiative to open up language and conversation about public safety in a way that didn't have a start from sort of individual punishment, and the only sort of measure of our response in public safety was how tough or how soft we were. So first and foremost, I think reinvestment was meant to address language and the policy conversations that were so knotted up. Secondly, it was meant to address incentives, which as a result of the kind of change in a very long national transition that focused on punishment and crime responses as the primary avenue to public safety, incentives had increasingly become all pointing towards prison. That is, whether it's parole and probation decision making, whether it's police discretion at arrest or prosecutorial approaches, and even, of course, the reduction in judicial discretion. In other words, our kind of loss of faith in judgment and locking up sentencing judges in grids that didn't allow them to use their discretion. So the whole idea behind reinvestment was bring the question back down to the places where it has the greatest impact, where crime and incarceration have the greatest impact, and that is those neighborhoods and those places, and start from there. And I think that once we started that, we started to see legislators speaking a different language and not being so trapped in that getting tough, being soft polemic that nobody really wanted to be in anymore.
Great. Well, thank you for that overview. So this podcast series is focused on issues related to poverty, and the overview of justice reinvestment you just gave provided an insight into high incarceration communities and local areas that where crime is highly concentrated. So I just wonder, in your research and the work you've done in mapping criminal justice populations to particular zip codes, what does your research tell you about poverty and its relationship to crime? Can you speak to that at all?
Well, sure. I mean, and again, this may be confirmed or at least magnified by mapping high concentration, high incarceration neighborhoods. But what we've learned over decades among both criminologists and sociologists and so on is that, you know, we get a little confused, and it's part of the myth that we're trying to break open here, between crime and incarceration and the relationship between the two, as well as the sort of backdrop in which both those phenomena exist, and that is places that are suffering a great deal of poverty. What we know is that crime is much more affected by social megatrends, you know, sort of the labor market, unemployment levels, levels of poverty, etc. Crime trends tend to have a lot more to do with the state of that of those megatrends than they do with approaches to punishment, like incarceration. So that, in fact, states that first started to adopt justice reinvestment initiatives were realizing and asking themselves, why is it that after years of national drops in crime rates to lowest rates since the 1950s and 60s, are we, the states, not realizing a dividend in reduced prison population? And what became evident increasingly to those states was that incarceration is driven by incarceration policy more than it is driven by crime rates, even though they have some effect, and that crime rates are driven more by poverty and social economic megatrends than they are by the effects of incarceration policy. So untangling those two from one another and realizing that, you know, crime is much more related to poverty than incarceration helped us aid states in being more strategic about how they use public safety resources to deal with the challenges of poverty, disenfranchisement, social isolation, et cetera, suffered by those particular communities, which were being exacerbated by the intense incarceration policies, not the crime rates, the incarceration policies that states had accumulated over three decades of increasingly ratcheting up individual punishment as a way to deal with public safety. In some ways, even if it wasn't intended as such, what's happened is that incarceration became the number one response to poverty. And once one starts to see that link, it became evident that that first will never solve poverty, but second, that it's a bit misfiring against crime prevention policies. So that, I think, was the most important thing, to untangle this mythology that the more we incarcerate, the less crime we'll have, and instead start to realize that incarceration has become a phenomenon like poverty, almost, in those places, and that that is not caused by crime rates as much as it is caused by incarceration policies that are that are changeable.
Thank you for that. And so what you just outlined indicates that incarceration is a reactive approach to crime. I'm wondering if you can sort of get into how justice reinvestment can be seen as a proactive approach to prevent crime and perhaps address poverty?
Well, that's a good question. And the way reinvestment was originally conceived as an initiative regarding crime was less as a crime prevention tactic, for which we have had a great deal of productive research over the years, and which tend to often be tactical kinds of approaches, sometimes by law enforcement, et cetera. But that what reinvestment was looking to do was interrupt a cycle of mass community incarceration that was in itself becoming a factor, a factor of distress in the neighborhood, above and beyond and unrelated almost to crime. So that now we were not just trying to, we were not just missing the target by using incarceration to fight crime as the primary and only approach, but we were also causing problems in these neighborhoods that were already suffering from disinvestment and poverty by creating this mass population displacement and resettlement process, which we may not have been aiming at, but when we look at it on our maps demographically, what we see are ludicrously high rates of parenting and working-aged, primarily men, being removed and returned from community to prison and back to community, on average for 2 to 3 years, en masse, every year, a kind of project that in many ways adds this kind of self-induced mass migration challenge to places that are already challenged by under-resourced and little access to opportunities than other neighborhoods that are right next to them. So the idea was first and foremost to break that chain, that sort of shooting ourselves in the foot approach to using incarceration as the primary, if not sole, response to crime, but really, when looked at geographically, to poverty. And instead to see from a neighborhood community perspective what the trade-offs are between using resources to rent prison cells, which is essentially what we're doing for 2 or 3 years, versus investing in a more kind of public safety mortgage in the neighborhood, building something year to year in and year out. Because some of what we did with Million Dollar Blocks was to dramatize this issue that we're the state spending more than $1 million a year in some to remove and return people from particular blocks in particular high incarceration neighborhoods. But none of that money is going into those neighborhoods. None of those conditions are changing in those neighborhoods where we have the highest concentrations of people going in and out of prison. And the idea was to dramatize the potential for local areas to take over and make decisions about what public safety means to them. Does it mean renting prison cells for a couple of years for people to come back harmed and, with prison culture kind of ingrained even further in them en masse to neighborhoods that were already suffering these problems? Secondly, the reinvestment proportion, sort of section dimension of justice reinvestment was meant to say, look, let's reclaim those dollars, those resources, and those aren't the only kind of resources, from a perspective at the community level, and pool them with existing dollars at the local levels that are already going towards addressing issues of the conditions in those neighborhoods, whether it's healthcare or stable housing, et cetera, and try to remove this kind of siloed approach of different agencies working with large proportions of the population in those neighborhoods, but without any knowledge of one another and without any leveraging together of their own resources in addressing sometimes the very same families.
Great, thank you. Now, there's been a great deal of momentum recently on criminal justice reform. There's bills moving through Congress with bipartisan support, and unusual allies like Tea Partier, Senator Mike Lee out of Utah, and liberal Congressman Bobby Scott out of Virginia. And states have continued to adopt changes in policy and work to address their prison populations. And there's been a lot of documentation over that over the last few years. I'm just wondering if you've thought about this momentum and how it can be leveraged to realize the goal of justice reinvestment as a concept, put that into practice more and more.
Yes, and you know, I think that is a sign of how far we've come since about a decade ago when reinvestment was first launched, just in terms of the policy discussion that's going on, even at the high levels of government, at the federal level, let alone the state level, and so on. But I think we are reaching now, after a decade of this work, a kind of a crucial turning point, where if we don't start to think about how to leverage this progress, we're gonna reach a kind of staying point now, where we may have reduced the growth, if not stayed off the current growth of the prison system nationally, but we will have done so at a level that is the highest in history, and we'll not have redressed the level of incarceration that we now have. It will rather have just simply stopped the growth, but we'll be stuck on some level with current high, unsustainable levels of incarceration. So I think we're at a crucial turning point, and I think, you know, in many ways, this is why I say there's many justice reinvestments. The reinvestment initiative that perhaps has now been running its course at the state level, where state government has taken on the issue and is trying to address it, where the federal government is now pitching in and realizing that states are taking this approach, where, in fact, the whole federal government, including the attorney general and so on, are now talking about this somewhat counterproductive approach to public safety, that we need to start thinking about the missing component. And it always brings us back to the local environment. And today, what I think we need to do to leverage the gains that have been made so far is to raise a justice reinvestment initiative that is at a city, municipal, or county level, as distinct from the state level advocacy that has been very successful so far at what it has done, but may be reaching a ceiling and may be in need of what I would say is local risk sharing. I think that there's an inherent limit to what state legislators and legislatures will do with regard to reforming incarceration policy. And while they've started to do that, I think it's only at the local, municipal, and county level that we can go further than we have, that a real bite into the domination of and dependence on incarceration for dealing with crime and maybe more often poverty in local neighborhoods is going to be a question for local city councils, mayors, police chiefs, prosecutors, county commissioners, and so on. Were they to adopt a justice reinvestment approach, I think we would start to see a risk sharing with state level legislatures that would take us further than we've gone so far. And I think there's a real on the ground reason for that, in part. You can't really change these things unless the local players where the consequences of these changes are going to show up have bought in. But secondly, even though our primary focus over the many decades has been statutory legislative change at the state level, change that is absolutely required, we are missing to some extent the remarkable amount of discretion that exists at the local level across the criminal justice sector, from police to prosecutors and alternatives to incarceration and so on. So much can be done to affect imprisonment rates simply by practice discretion among the police and prosecutors who want to do something more productive than arrest and incarcerate. that they can make changes that even state legislative change might not be able to achieve. And in fact, even when state legislative change is enacted, local discretion has a big impact on the extent to which those legislative changes are stymied or accelerated. And so I think the next focus, the focus in the future, has to be on the sort of county and city mayoral, county commissioner, large nonprofit, grasstop stakeholders, and so on, to take on justice reinvestment as a local campaign and initiative. And I think they will find that if they do so, they'll have even more luck and more success at reclaiming those state prison dollars and other kinds of state dollars that are somehow, for some reason, being used to subsidize criminal justice at the local level, and allow them to reclaim those dollars to be used in much more productive local innovations for addressing both crime and poverty.
Well, great. Thank you for bringing out those issues. So I'm just wondering, as we wrap up, if you've seen any examples at the local level in terms of changing the incentives around, local crime control efforts and reclaiming those dollars in a way that can meet the needs of county and municipal governments. What is the mechanism to create those incentives? We talked about the tensions around legislative approach, and I heard you say that while it's an important strategy, there needs to be other ways to think about this. So I'm just wondering if there's any specific examples you can share in terms of rethinking this approach at the local level that would be helpful for listeners.
Sure, and I think there are different types of models and components that are usable and are proving to be successful. I would hearken back to I'm happy to acknowledge the model from which I kind of stole on some level and refashioned the idea of justice reinvestment from work that was done back in the 90s in Oregon, where a very innovative juvenile justice director, Dennis Maloney, who was working in Deschutes County, Oregon, innovated some remarkable approaches to restoring sanity to how dollars were being spent on behalf of their communities and their county's public safety. And on the juvenile level, what Dennis found was that, the state was spending X millions of dollars to incarcerate juveniles in state facilities from Deschutes County each year. And at the same time, he was on the school board and found that they were simply looking for enough money to patch up a hole in the roof of the local high school. And so he organized local business people, county commissioners, et cetera, around this misapportioned resource decision-making, lobbied the state legislature, which in the end passed a bill that said, okay, from now on, the state of Oregon is going to give Deschutes County a block grant every year in the amount that the state had been spending to incarcerate juveniles from that county. And with one proviso, of course, that the county can no longer send the state juveniles for incarceration. And if they do, they're going to get charged back, which is an old sort of chargeback idea from even the 70s in terms of thinking about criminal justice. But they adopted this, and lo and behold, they reduced juvenile incarceration, state incarceration in Deschutes County by almost 70% right off the bat. Because when that money and those decisions were put more in local hands, they were much more nuanced and innovative about how those dollars were spent in response to crime and the other social economic challenges that those neighborhoods were facing. And one of the first things they did was they moved the juvenile probation system into the toughest neighborhood in the county. They made it a neighborhood probation approach. They massively expanded community service as a way to deal with criminal transgression and to restore people who had, you know, in fact, committed crimes in the area. They also, though, invested in things other than criminal justice by bringing people from around the country to help them understand what works best. And they invested in everything from home visitation nursing care to pre-K education, in addition to neighborhood probation. So that was a great model that we tried to elaborate on through justice reinvestment, which we kind of are seeing now on the adult level happening in a few different places. I mean, the big kind of story about getting control and reducing the overuse of imprisonment could be found in New York City, where over the last decade and a half, police and prosecutorial discretion and policies have been used to be much smarter about how we approach crime in New York City, and much greater use of alternatives and diversion programs that, while enacting punishment, don't do so in a way that shoot ourselves in the foot so that we have to deal with so many people being removed and returned after prison in those neighborhoods. And New York City has reduced its jail population in half over that time, from about 21,000 to around 11,000 people, and has reduced all of the state's 30% reduction in the state prison population is due entirely to what went on in New York City over those years. So there's a real example of how local discretion and smart policymaking can radically impact those the overuse of prison and jail. But there are also examples, for example, in Kansas, where justice reinvestment went early on in its journey through the country and stimulated some very innovative legislation. For example, in Kansas, the state legislature was trying to address the vast proportion of people coming to prison as a result of parole and probation revocation. So they crafted legislation that said to local parole and probation, if you can reduce your commitments to prison safely by 25%, the state will reward you with, again, a block grant to reinvest those dollars in those strategies that are keeping people locally and developing local approaches rather than resorting so quickly to imprisonment. And, of course, that had an immediate impact the first year. Local probation in Wichita was able to reduce more than 20% the revocations to prison and jail because the incentives had been reversed, not only financial, but cultural, because these incentives are tied all the way through these departments, whether it's the police or parole and probation. And unless there is a reversal both in terms of authorizing line workers to start thinking differently and reversing the financial disincentives to coming up with local solutions, then you're not going to get much change. So I think there are great examples of this. If what happens is decision-making and financing is increasingly devolved to local areas, which will not end up wasting the money on endless renting of prison cells with no benefits for their own local area.
Well, thank you so much for sharing those examples. And it's great that there are models around the country, not just in the Northeast in states like New York, but also in the Midwest, like in states like Kansas and out West, like Oregon. So thank you for
Absolutely.
That. So, you know, we'll wrap up the podcast here, this segment of the podcast series here, Eric, and I do thank you for your time. Before I let you go, just wanted to ask if there's anything you wanted to share or leave with listeners before we close out.
Well, I appreciate your focus on this issue, Nicole, and I think the last thing I would say that is perhaps maybe the more nuanced kind of thinking about reinvestment and the way we address crime and poverty is that, you know, we've come to feel, and it's hard for us to break out of this notion that the only way to punish criminal transgression is through iron bars and concrete walls. There are so many ways to punish criminal transgression in ways that don't end up shooting us in the foot. And perhaps the single most underused approach is obligatory, full-time, supervised community service, which can both address the transgression, but also in a way that is not only not harmful, but in fact may be a way of restoring to some extent the harms that were done through crimes to the places that are most in need of those issues. And that, in addition to sort of using more community service and building on local knowledge, what people know on the ground in local areas, so that all our solutions aren't plopping down giant service centers, but rather smartly investing in the local economic, social, health networks that people already use in disadvantaged neighborhoods to grapple with their conditions. And if we can reinvest in those networks and strengthen them, I think you get a much more productive, natural, and low-cost way to improve conditions in those places and let people improve their own circumstances rather than necessarily saying this is all something that has to come from without.
Okay, thank you so much. So we had Eric Cador, who is director of the Justice Mapping Center and on faculty in the Criminal Justice Department at Rutgers University. One of the initiatives of the Justice Mapping Center is to map studies of criminal justice population concentrations. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you, Nicole.